Today's talk is given by Professor Jonathan Silbertown, and his talk is entitled Making Edinburgh the First Global City of Learning. Jonathan Silbertown is Professor of Evolutionary Ecology in the Institute of Evolutionary Biology and holds the Chair of Technology Enhanced Science Education in the School of Biological Sciences here at Edinburgh. And he has won awards for engagement with and understanding of ecology. Professor Silbertown is also the author of numerous research publications and also a popular science author. And his most recent title is The Long and the Short of It, The Science of Lifespan and Aging, published by Chicago University Press in 2013. And in September, Chicago University Press again will publish Jonathan's next book, Dinner with Darwin, Food, Drink and Evolution. Jonathan has also devised several citizen science web projects that crowdsource biological data. iSpotNature.org is a social network that rapidly and accurately identifies observations of alien species of wildlife and has had 500,000 observations and 30,000 species identified to date. EvolutionMegalab.org is an online survey of polymorphism and evolution in banded snails that operate throughout Europe. And on the spatial side of things, we have TreeZilla.org. This is the monster map of trees. And that aims to map all the trees in Britain and calculate the value of their ecosystem services. And finally, perhaps our subject for today, Jonathan is now working on a new infrastructure for citizen inquiry called Edinburgh CityScope. And this will enable students and the public to collect, access and analyse data of all kinds in the cities and environments. So with a rich ecology of projects and apps, we therefore look forward indeed to a very interesting talk. I warmly welcome Jonathan Silver.
Thank you, Owen. So you basically preceded my talk, and I'll take questions. pretty much. Yeah, well, a lot of what you mentioned is true. I've done it. But it's not a clue to what I'm going to talk to you about today, other than a little bit about the Edinburgh CityScope. And the idea behind this is, imagine a city, the one we live in, or the one we're sitting in now, as a learning environment, the entire city, a place where you can walk around and discover information about any topic at all that can be mapped about where you are. So the geology, the social history, the quality of the air, the birds, the plants, anything at all. And not only can you discover what's going on around you, but you can also contribute data to that. So that's what I mean by a city of learning. And actually, it's not you. Robert Louis Stevenson walked around the city with two books in his pocket, apparently. In one, he wrote, and the other was for reading. So most of us carry a smartphone, and that enables us to do, in the digital age, exactly what Robert Louis Stevenson did, which is actually find out about where we are and record what we are using a camera or whatever, you know, all the other things that we have on our phones, sound and so on. So we can actually do all this as individuals and contribute to learning. And this is an outline of my talk. I'm going to... how long did you say I had? I'm going to keep it short. Well, as short as I can. In the hope that there'll be lots of questions at the end. I do confess I gave this talk about 2 months ago at King's Buildings, and at least one person in the audience has told me that he was there. I'm going to assume that he's the only one. But this is something that actually I think should involve the whole city, so that's why I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you all in geography in particular about this. So... Why is Edinburgh the place to make a city of learning? Well, I'm going to talk about this under these three headings. There's the history, the culture, and the place, and of course, the university. So just to look at history briefly, if you go to the high street, you'll see this gentleman, David Hume, one of the greatest philosophers Britain ever produced. And if, as a tourist, you can rub his toe, he will tell you what he thinks of professors. There's nothing to be learned from a professor which is not to be met with in books. I'm sorry, I can't do the Scottish accent. I won't insult you by trying. But apparently he said this in a letter to a friend. It may have had something to do with the fact that he was twice turned down for a chair at the University of Edinburgh. Britain's greatest philosophers, but there you go. Further down the street, you'll meet Adam Smith. In the portrait gallery, you'll see this picture of Joseph Black, who discovered carbon dioxide, amongst other things. This is James Hutton, the geologist, whose house is just over the way at the other side of the Pleasance. Well, what the site of his house? The Fortune House was demolished. And all these people, of course, were part of the Scottish Enlightenment. And it was said at the time that by a visitor to Edinburgh, you could stand in the high street and in the space of half an hour, you could shake by the hand 50 men of genius. Men, note, women were invisible at that time, I'm afraid, in this context. So for geographers and biologists such as myself, James Hutton is probably the most notable, the most significant character of this period, and that, as you'll recognise, is Salisbury Crags, which he could see from his house, from his cottage. Here is the Hutton section. And the significance of the Hutton section was that it was one of the demonstrations that Hutton used, and just being outside his house practically, I guess he would take visitors to see it, in which he could show that the geological processes must take a lot of time. So remember that the standard theological view of the age of the earth back in the 18th century and earlier was that of Bishop Usher, who calculated that the earth had been created in 4004 BC. He did this by using the genealogies of the Bible to work backwards. So-and-so began so-and-so, Methuselah was 900 years old, and so on. And he put all that together, rather like reconstructing a dendrochronology, I suppose. And you end up with a date like that. And what Hutton said was that actually, here you've got basalt, which is a volcanic rock, and it intruded through a sedimentary rock. These are processes you can see going on at the moment. You can see sedimentation going on. You can see lava coming out of the ground. And the fact that this has kind of come out through the middle and gone in there, there's a sort of tongue here, which I can see at this angle, showing that these processes are not all just sedimentation, which is what some geologists at the time thought. And if you look at how long it would take to accumulate the kind of depth of rock that they're around, the different layers and so on, it's just a long, long time. He didn't actually, I believe, put a time scale to it, but people later on did. But essentially, he said there's no way this happened in 6,000 years. Why is that important? Well, of course, there's a famous phrase here, which was in his book, The Theory of the Earth. No vestige, the rocks have show no vestige of a beginning and no prospect of an end, because these processes are cyclical and just go on and on and on. And that was really important as... that was really important as the geological foundation for Charles Darwin's theory of evolution. He, of course, was also a student in Edinburgh for 2 years, a student of medicine before he decided he'd go and become a clergyman in Cambridge, if that was more comfortable. So without that expanded timescale, it simply wouldn't, evolution by natural selection couldn't work. There wouldn't be enough time for it. So all these things add up to, you'll be familiar with these, the most extraordinary basis on which to construct a city of learning. There's a lot of exciting things that connect with modern science today that we can see in the streets around us, if only we have the means to discover. We also, of course, have, and here I don't mean to exclude science from culture, but culture in the conventional sense is also abundant. I mean, this is the World Heritage Site, the new town, the old town, designated by UNESCO for its cityscape, for its architecture and so on. So we have that extraordinary thing. We also have the Fringe Festival and the International Festival, the in total the biggest arts festival in the world. My family and I have been coming to this for a long time. This has been my children on the train returning back to Milford Keynes way back in 2002. And these are all the things that we managed to do in 4 days. So now there's even more things. Last year there were 3,000 different performances, I believe, in the Fringe alone. And of course, Edinburgh is a city of literature, the first city of literature recognised by UNESCO, and J.K. Rowling has said it's impossible to live in Edinburgh without sensing its literary heritage everywhere. So, and here's an example. This is a mural on the meadows, just south of George Square, commemorating Muriel Sparks, the prime minister Eugene Brodie, significance being Gillespie School, which is the one that features in the book, just the other side of the meadows. So everywhere you go, there are reminders of just how important place is in Edinburgh. And this is a wonderful app, which I have nothing to do with. I'm not promoting this because of my own involvement with it, produced by James Loxley in English. So he's a professor of early voice English. And he does what I understand is called digital humanities. And what he and colleagues in informatics did was they digitized, or they took digital copies of 500 books dating back to the 17th century that mention Edinburgh, that take place in Edinburgh, or that have some mention of Edinburgh. And they text mined those books, they cross matched it. They searched for place names that were in a gazetteer, they mapped all those place names, and they linked them to snippets of the work, of the works, and they managed to find 44,000 references in those 500 books to identifiable places in Edinburgh. And you can look it all up on an app called Glitchlon, and it looks like this. It's available on iPhone and Android, I think. And if you just touch one of these pen nibs, you can actually look at a reference to in literature to where you happen to be standing. So again, we have a richness of place, and this is the one part of the university where I don't have to really say anything about OpenStreetMap other than how great it is, and that this is an open source map that we can use in projects like LitLong and other things. Okay, so and there's a community behind this, of course, which is, if you like, even more important than the existence of the map, is the existence of people who want to do this kind of thing. So there's another project called Mapping Edinburgh Social History, MESH, which uses this and maps social history onto here. So where are the butchers in 1900? Where were the chimney sweeps in 1870 and things of that kind? To go back to the question, why Edinburgh? Well, of course, not only have we got all this sense of place, but also we know which way is up. This is San Jose in Silicon Valley. Somebody needs to be able to tell them that north and south are not at right angles to each other. I saw this in the National Library a couple of months ago. If you were to believe this map, of course, we are at the centre of the globe. But the key thing about this wonderful map by Cable and Wireless is that it shows the beginnings of what is now, we now call the internet. I mean, what is the internet? All these lines are cables. And, of course, the key thing about the globe now and the presence of the internet is that everybody's at the centre of the world. That you can rotate this, and of course, you can put anybody in the middle of a web that joins everybody up. Ignoring the sort of imperial grandeur of this map, it does have a sense of truth even today, for wherever you are. And we're outward looking. Of course, Edinburgh University is very international. 45% of our students are from outside the UK. And this is what was blazoned on the wall of the castle at the beginning of the International Festival last year, with flags all along the streets saying exactly the same thing a month after the rest of the UK voted for Brexit. So, it's going to be my only mention of that topic. I see somebody's leaving already. So how do we make a learning city? I mean, we have this extraordinary place with so much to learn, so much richness to explore for our students, for ourselves, in research projects. A lot of this is already going on. How do we make a learning city? So I'm going to look at it under these three topics. So first of all, what is learning in this context? What am I talking about? It's always a good idea to define your terms, even if you are 15 minutes in. Then look at it on how to use the research and learning, and then I'm going to show you how far we've got with the infrastructure by talking about Edinburgh City Scope. So what we're talking about here is learning by discovery, or what Cold called experiential learning, but I think that's unnecessarily jargonistic. And basically, it's that we learn through our experience in this sort of fashion here. So you have an experience, like listening to me talking, you reflect on it, you observe my slides, you think, God, this is awful. Then you have some idea about what I say, and you test it out in the questions afterwards, and then you the whole thing goes round, and you basically learn by this process. And I've treated that lightheartedly, but actually this is what's happening all the time, informally as well as formally. So that's the kind of learning that I'm talking about. And I'm going to give you a couple of examples, which Owen has already mentioned, but I'll show you just what I've done already along these lines at the Open University, where I was until 2.5-3 years ago. So this is iSpotNature.org, and it's designed as a way of helping people put names to living things. Why is that important? Well, for anybody interested in ecology or evolution or any whole organism biology, as I am, and as I expect some of you are, you need to know the names of the organisms if you want to do anything scientific or anything in conservation with those observations. There's no point in saying, I've just seen a white butterfly or a black-coloured bird. If you can't say what species is, that information is essentially of no value whatsoever. But the moment you can say what the species is, then somebody can tell you, oh, well, I saw one too. Did you know that they're migrating or they feed on this plant? Or, you know, and you can record the location as a piece of scientific data. Because maths, of course, in this context, in this room, I don't need to say this, maths are an essential form of data record in nature, as in so many other things. So what iSpot does is it uses a social network to crowdsource names. There are lots of people around who know the names of things. There are lots of people who would like to know the names of things. And iSpot brings them together inside a website. This is what the website looks like. And again, it's experiential learning. We created it to help people learn the names of organisms, which is not something that is formally taught in biological education, hasn't been for 50 years, at BSc level anyway. MSc courses, very specialised courses for learning names, but very few people take them. The average biologist, you know, will not know many names of things. You know, here the observation is, oh, that's a two-spot bat. I see this ladybird. The conceptualization is sort of putting a name to it, Adelia bicarpentata, and then you can test that knowledge by looking at other examples, say, is this a two-spot ladybird? Learn that, no, actually, maybe that's a harlequin ladybird, which is often confused with it, and so on. And then, you know, through feedback, which comes from the community, you then go around this. And we have seen people over the years, iSpot's been running nearly 9 years, we've seen people go from absolute beginners to amateur experts in a number of different fields. So this actually works. So we've got users all over the world, particularly in Britain and Western Europe and in Southern Africa. for reasons I will go into later if you're interested. But and I'm going to choose one out of, so we have nearly 700,000 observations. And I'm going to give you an example of just one, because it's really quite extraordinary, and demonstrates the power of this kind of interaction. So a few years ago, we got this this observation posted with the text of children in Zululand have eaten these seeds and are very ill. We need an ID if possible. We have a lot of South Africans on the site. They have their own section of the site, in fact. And 35 seconds later, somebody called Cassine, and these things indicate that they're a plant expert, and they work for the botanic gardens. And Cassine said, it's a visit, not a tree. And there's a thing here which is confidence. So we want people to, because this is about science, about learning, we want to encourage people to share the knowledge they have, qualified by how sure they are of, that it is what it is. Because if you know, it's like learning a language. If you're too scared to actually utter anything in words in French, you're never going to learn French or anything else. You've got to be able to test, you know, the experiential learning thing. You've got to be able to test your knowledge in that circle in order to see whether it's right or wrong and gain confidence and keep going round and keep learning. So we have the this thing here. You can say whether I'm as sure as I can be, it's likely to be this, or it may be this. We just have those three categories. And here, Cassine said, it's likely to be this, but I can't be certain. But then some other people agreed, two people agreed with the certification. So iSpot then looks at, adds up all the reputation weight behind this, and goes over a threshold that says this is a likely identification. We deliberately use the term likely identification, because at the end of the day, all this is a photograph. It's not the actual organism on a herbarium sheet that's been, if you like, cross-checked against the holotype or anything like that. So behind this apparently simple process, there's a lot of thought about how people learn and what you can say, given the evidence. Of course, about evidence, because it's a science. Anyway, the thrilling thing was, that the very next day, we got this message back from the doctor that said, thank you for your participation in the clinical seat. I'm happy to report that the five children are all fine now. They were sick. They were fine the next day. And it's not the first time we've had kids come in having eaten these seeds. And now we know what we're up against. So that was an extraordinary thing. There are other talk stories I can tell you about identifying invasive organisms, all kinds of things. But the key thing here is that this is only possible because you bring people together into a community of people who know stuff and people who want to know stuff. And what was great is that the need for the knowledge was in Zululand. The person who provided the name was 1,500 kilometres away in Cape Town, and it all happened via a server sitting in Milton Keynes. Here is the point about the globe and everything being joined up, and it doesn't really matter where you are, so long as you are connected with the right people. So we're talking here about a borderless community, a virtuous circle of learning, and encouraging. Basically, I'm just throwing that in at this point because one of the things that's happened in iSpot is that people have started using it in ways we didn't anticipate. They started creating sub-communities. They started creating their own collections of things that just interest them. And because we provided them with tools that are useful, they're basically making the site their own. And it's when that happens that you really know that you've been successful. That's my philosophy. So now moving on to research and learning, I'm just going to show you a couple of other examples. Mainly I'm going to talk about the Evolution Megalab in this context. So the Evolution Megalab, again, as Owen mentioned, is, we created this in 2009, which was Darwin's 200th birthday. It also happened to be the 150th anniversary of the publication of The Origin of Species, because he wrote it, published it when he was 50. And we wanted to create something which would enable the general public and our students and anybody else to have a first-hand experience of what evolution is really all about. And not just to read about it in books or lovely TV programs, which you also made. And so, basically, I hit upon the idea that we would use the banded snail, which is this thing here. So, and all of these snails belong to, they're all different colours and banding patterns, but they all belong to the same species. And this is a related species, this is here, Nemoregus, this is Hortensis, and this is a related species, and it has the same variety of banding patterns. So what you've got here is a highly variable species. It's extremely common. It occurs in Edinburgh, all over Europe, in fact. And both of them do. And these different colours of banding patterns have a known genetic basis. In fact, it's now even been the actual genes have now been sequenced. And they vary from, nearly all populations are polymorphic, contain at least two of these types, and the proportions of the different types vary in relation to the environment. So they vary in relation to, for example, whether it's grassland or hedgerow or woodland. They vary across the country to some extent, across Europe, that I'm going to show you in just a moment. They vary in relation to environmental temperature. There's a good evidence they also vary in relation to predation by thrushes, which can see some forms easier than others, depending on the background they're searching. So this is a map of Europe with squares indicating the predominant colour of Sapir nemoregus. At each of the points where the colour they're actually circled, you can't see that on this screen. And so the yellow, the ones that are very yellow, there's lots of yellow ones. The more orangey red ones are the lots of brown shells. And basically there is a geographic gradient, this incline from southern Europe across to northern Europe in increasing brown colour. And we're pretty sure that this is because actually what happens is that if you are a dark coloured snail like this down here, in sunlight you cook. The inside of the shell can get up to 40 degrees C, which is fatal for a snail. Whereas up here in the north, if you're a light coloured snail in the kind of environment we live in, where you don't see a lot of sunlight, you won't often be warm enough to get out and feed and mate. So you can see there are clear reasons why there would be selection in favour of yellow shells down here and darker ones up there. But it's highly variable because there are all sorts of other things going on as well. So what we did was we created a couple of hypotheses we wanted to test with the general public. It's my firm belief that when you do citizen science like this, it mustn't be busy work. It would be easy to just say, go out and do this, it'll be fun. We actually say we want you, the public, to help us test some hypotheses, which are asking genuine questions to which we do not know the answer. We have reasons for proposing these hypotheses, which we explain, but we did not know the answer. And the hypothesis I'm going to tell you about now is to do with climate. So we know that the climate in Europe over the last 40 to 50 years has increased by mean temperature has increased by about 1.5 degrees C. And we know that the snails are sensitive to temperature and that this affects, and this, that the body temperature is affected by the colour of the shell. We also had data from the 1960s, and so we asked the public to help us collect new data so that we could remap the frequency of the different colours and test the hypothesis that because of the warming of the climate, the frequency of yellow shells will have increased in areas where it used to be low. So in other words, this gradient would have changed in favour of more yellow further north. In fact, we found that did happen, but only in exposed environments, basically in sand dunes. Elsewhere, snails have an option that we didn't think of in advance, which is they can run away and hide. Well, they don't run, they can slide away and hide. In sand dunes, it's a lot harder to find a place to hide. There's all this reflective sand around as well. And there, we did find a significant increase in the frequency of yellow morphs further north. But the most extraordinary thing we found was across the whole of Europe, there had been an increase in the shell type with a single band around the middle. We have no idea why, but then that's science. So, and of course, you know, then one goes on and does more. So we're sort of, you know, one cycle round the experiential thing. So the lessons of Icebot, MakerLab, are that everybody can contribute. The beauty of this animal is that it can be safely handled by small children, and safe for the snail if you're worried about snails, and also safe for children. I did have a research assistant at the time who was shocked that I wanted to create a picture and show of very much of them, but anyway, she wouldn't let me do it. So there are people who care about snails, or others who like to eat them. This is real science. I've already emphasised that, so we ended up with a publication in PLOS, a peer-reviewed publication, and there have actually been about six papers now using these data, and they've actually been published, so anybody can use them. And the project's still going. In fact, we're trying to turn it mobile now. Back in 2009, the iPhone was a new thing, and most people didn't have smartphones and so on. So we did actually have mobile technology there. We need it now. So we're hoping to be able to update the project. And a key thing about this sort of thing is data quality. So if you are having three-year-olds put in data or with their mum, you have to be sure, and actually even if they're 30-year-olds, you have to be sure that they really are identifying the right species. These two are different. They have to be able to tell them, both of them, from the common garden snail, have to work out, you know, what the right banding patterns and so on. So we did a lot of that, and learned quite a bit about how to do that. I mentioned trees earlier, the monster map of trees. So this was a sort of silly idea I had before leaving the OU, maybe why I had to leave. Basically, the idea is that we're creating here a database of trees which we can then ask people to help us identify. So we use Google Street View. You can see the trees, this is the meadows. And then people can go there and say, okay, this is true. Measure a tree, identify it, put the information in, and we have some algorithms that actually calculate the ecosystem service values of those trees, what effect are they having on, given their size, the canopy and so on cooling the local environment, moderating hydrology, all those kinds of things. So this is actually now a collaboration with Forest Research, and they're developing it. So it's still to be really launched in a sort of final version. But one of the lessons that we learned was actually it's much better to build on existing technology than to reinvent everything or to invent things entirely yourself. So Icebot was built entirely from scratch, MegaLab ditto, and TreeZilla is actually built on software that was produced in the States for a similar purpose, and we just reskinned it, basically. That's sort of how I got to this point. And meanwhile, in Edinburgh itself, all sorts of other exciting things have been going on. I want to mention Edinburgh Living Lab. So this is a project run by James Stewart, sort of in a building over there somewhere, social political science, and people in informatics and people in the art college. And they get their MSc students to take on commissions, if you like, from the local council, from Edinburgh Council, and then they used technology and design to try and address those. So, for example, this is far too small, but this is a map of bike tracks. initiated coming from the bike counters that you see around the world, on Little Meadow Walk, for example. And this is a map, completely invisible, which maps the nitrogen dioxide levels that have been recorded by citizens, again from the council. So there are already lots of students doing this kind of thing. That you'll probably tell me that you have student courses doing similar things. I wouldn't be at all surprised. And then the other thing we've got is that just growing at the moment is the Internet of Things. And this is a new network, which I can talk more about later, but essentially it's sensors that can record all kinds of things and transmit the data using low energy radio frequency around the city. And it's being used to monitor all kinds of things. So there are already things going on, tackling real world problems involving the public, and a friend of mine told me that this isn't interdisciplinary, this is post-disciplinary. The students who we're going to be turning out and the kind that we're going to be perhaps most employable are the ones who can do all of this stuff. They're going to be able to identify a problem, analyse it, and use all sorts of technology, or know who they can go to for the kinds of technology to solve these things, and not simply be biologists or geologists. So, now we come to the infrastructure itself, Edinburgh Cityscope, and this is what we're building to try and synergise all this stuff that's going on, so that in future, when people want to create a new project, like iSport or Treezilla or something and so on, they don't have to start from scratch. When you do, I know to my cost, actually, how difficult that is. You first have to have the idea, then you have to convince somebody that this is a good idea, good enough that they should give you some money, and then when you've got the money, you have to find the people to build the project, and then when you've got it, you then have to get people to use it. And each of those things is really difficult. And at the moment, certainly, each time somebody has a good idea, they've got to climb each of those hills on their own without support from the people who've done it before, but in a slightly different way on a slightly different topic. So the idea of Edinburgh Cityscope is it will give us in Edinburgh, and at the moment it will be in the university, but we intend it to be city-wide, and ultimately it can be worldwide, we'll be able to help each other. So there'll be synergy in that sense, but also between learning, research and engagement. Because you'll have already realised that the things I've been talking about cover all of those things. So this is Edinburgh Cityscope, and we thought hard about what it is that we really need to make. What is it? What does an infrastructure of this kind need to contain? Is it possible to make it future-proof? The world is technological world is moving at such a rate that it would be very easy to start building something in year one of your project and have it obsolete and overtaken by something else by year three. So we basically decided that we had to think conceptually about this in terms of function rather than actual code at the very beginning. So there are three things that you will need always. I mean, I can't conceive a situation where these three things wouldn't be true. You'll need data. We're always going to need data. I don't think data as a sort of object are ever going to be obsolete. And if they're maps, you're all well aware of the fact, of course, beauty of having things on that, so you can overlay them and you can relate what's in one data layer to what's in another. I'm not going to mention the three-letter acronym. But anyway, so we already have lots of tools for doing this kind of thing, so long as the data are all georeferenced. Then you've got the data, so you need some way of analysing those data. We call this a workbench, and we're using Jupyter notebooks, Jupyter Hub for this. So I said we weren't. So we came up with this need, and then we said, what should we use? And that is what we're using now, but it could be replaced by something else. But we will always need a layer for that. The data are put on GitHub, so the idea is that everything is open. And then the third layer is a presentation layer. So it's what you do with your analysis. So it might be you turn it into an app, might be you put it on a web page, it might be you just submit it as an assignment to, for your course. But you'll need some sort of output. And so we've made some progress in each of these areas that I'm just going to show you. So the look at data first of all. So we've imported to our data store on GitHub, which you can look at, it's open. Open data from the Scottish Government's Open Data Portal. So this is a map going through our workbench of lung cancer registrations in Edinburgh up to 2001. And here you can see the same thing between 2005 and 2009. So there's a bit of change. And this is just for demonstration purposes, but of course you can create a difference map and you can start investigating, you know, why has it changed. And this is the Scottish Index for Multiple Deprivation for Edinburgh, again mapped using open data through our workbench. And I'm not showing you two versions of that because sadly it is extremely resistant to change, and the worst indices of diversity of deprivation are down here, and they have been for a century. So one of the ambitions of Leslie McCara, who's the vice principal for outreach, is that Cityscope will help us track this. And over the next 20 years, the university will be doing things, and Cityscope might be or might not be part of it, will be doing things that will change this and will actually improve life for the most deprived in Edinburgh. So our workbench at the moment is pretty. It has a bunch of buttons which fire up different things. So one of them opens up Jupyter Notebooks, another one gives you APIs, which enable you to plug the data that you pull into the analyses that you've done into, for example, apps. This is a really neat one. This one actually starts a blog which turns into an app, and I'll tell you a little bit about that in a moment. And then you can also start up an app, an instance of Field Trip Open, which is a data collecting app, which some of you may want to use. And this is very much in the sort of prototype phase. So we will be looking for people to help us test this at some point. At that point, maybe through Owen, I'll try and get invite some of you to have a go. And then we, in the presentation layer, we've basically got two apps essentially at the moment that can be repurposed. So the point, you remember, is that everything should be synergistic, that things that people do should be reusable by others. And so this is Nikki Vermeulen, also from SPS, just over there. She's actually a historian and sociologist of science. And she wanted to create a tour of the history of science in Edinburgh. As I've already mentioned, of course, there are extraordinary riches in that field. And so she created this thing called Curious Edinburgh, and Edina, part of Information Services, had the genius idea that they would use a blog to create this. So this is a WordPress blog. I expect a number of people in the room have their own blogs using WordPress. Very easy to set up. I mean, you don't need to be IT literate really to do it. And each entry, each post in this blog gets fed automatically to an app called Curious Edinburgh, so you can actually find this now in the App Store or in Google Play. That has displays the entries from Nikki's blog in the form of a list and also in the form of a map with root on it if you want. And it's possible to create new versions of this. So I created my own version of a blog, so using the same software, and it actually is a tour of the Botanic Gardens, which we're going to use in September, October, with our students in biology. So, and you do it simply by putting the we're using, so technically we're using a WordPress blog as a content management system for an app. So this is something that a lot of people are excited about. It's really quite simple. Content in my app. And it should be possible for lots of people to create these for themselves. I'm hoping when we've got a bit more funding, this will be rolled out right across the university, so you can set your students an assignment to come up with like good idea for a tour, create it, share it, and see what happens, for example. So, and then the other pre-baked app, as I'm calling them, that we've got is something created previously by Adina, and this is Field Trip Open, which is essentially a data collecting app. It's generic, you can customize it using these buttons. It's actually available, I mean, we don't have an oscilloscope version, but it's actually available at the moment on the web. But again, we're adopting this because, you know, it's there already. It enables us to build on the offering, and we will be able to link these things to our Jupyter Workbench and to GitHub, where people will be able to store data. So we'll be able to offer something a bit more than just the plain old Field Trip Open. So at this point, I just mentioned that there's been some funding from Information Services. And we're beginning to get small amounts of funding in from research councils, essentially on the back of other projects. And I see this, once it's actually part of the university's technical infrastructure, as being incredibly useful, because when you write a research plan, you know, you can actually say that we're going to be using Edinburgh Cityscope to combine our data with what's already been collected. You know, it's going to be automatic, you know, in the pathways to impact. It's going to give you a sort of no-brainer, really, for saying how you're going to impact people with that data, and so on. So this is sort of a extremely limited list of things that we're going to do next. We need to pilot this with students. I was hoping to do it during the last Festival of Creative Learning, but we weren't really ready for that. We're going to form a community practice. A lot of people are actually interested in doing this. This will recognise the old infirmary, Royal Infirmary building, it's going to become Edinburgh Futures Institute, and we should have a home in there. We're beginning to connect with cultural institutions, city, so National Museum, National Library, the Internet of Things, so a network of sensors around the city that do different things, which feed data to a central point where our students can interact with those data. And being a biologist, I want to use the Internet of Things to actually sense the presence of organisms that make a noise. Now, actually, I'm a plant ecologist. Plants notoriously make rather little noise. They do make some, but you have to be very, very quiet to hear it. But seriously, it's possible to. So there are some now cool, some cool software for identifying bats from their sounds, and the chips that will do this for you. So my dream is that we will be able to create a network around Edinburgh with these sensors in trees and parks, people's gardens, and we will be able to, in real time, look at bat activity by named species of bats around the city. And of course, bats eat insects, and insects pollinate plants. So we have sort of way into the ecological web and through that kind of information. I'm just going to scoot through this now. And then, you know, who knows? Maybe we can emulate the city of literature and become a city of learning. So, here's the usual, well, here's an unusual list of of people to thank. Nothing like this happens without a huge number of people behind it. And so these were all the people who helped bring the idea to the point where, well, I don't know if I can say fruition at this point, but it's certainly a bug. And in information services, we have helped a lot of people to create what we have so far. But I'm going to give the last word to T.S. Eliot, because in Four Quartets, in a poem called Little Gidding, he actually describes experiential learning. He says, "We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." That's it. Thank you.
Right. Well, some time for questions.
Start off with 10 then. What do you think is the... Obviously, you want to do it, but as far as trying to get others involved, and obviously it takes work and stuff like that.
Yes.
What do you think is the main driver for getting other people involved? Is there going to be a payoff, do you think, like to increase tourism or something like that? Or is there going to be increased economic activity, because this then becomes a site of bringing all these bits together and connecting them together and pushing back the frontiers of that?
I think it's going to do those things. The difficulty is proving, especially in advance, that it might do that. So, we have a business model, but it's a case, I should say, which basically tries to quantify the payoffs, the benefits of this, in terms of what it does for university. And we're now being pushed by the friendly powers that be, and they are being friendly, I'm glad to say, to do the kinds of things you're saying. So, if you could get X number of visitors using this, what is that actually worth? And all these kinds of things. So, to some extent, this is, a matter of faith, really. But the way I see this, again, being a biologist, is what we're doing here is we're creating a seedbed. And I don't actually know what's going to grow in this seedbed. But...
you're doing it because you can, but we're trying to see if you can, like, technically.
Yes, yes. Well, technically we definitely can. We've got to the point where we can, we've made it. We've got a couple of apps. We've got a place where you can put data. We're using Jupyter Hub, which is used in lots of parts of the university. Increasingly, and actually, Edina and IS are going to be rolling this out, Jupyter Hub, across the university. So, I think lots of people who hear about this can see why it's a good idea. And then they say, you're not the first person to say, well, yeah, but how are you going to pay for it? And why should I give you money for this? And it's, to some extent, an act of faith. I mean, every investment is, So
just at the university level, does this provide infrastructure that will allow folk to do classes easier, organise
that is the idea.
Or whatever,
yes,
and
yes,
actually
yes.
expand the whole remit.
Yes, that is the basis of that is the basis of the business case that I've made so far. At the moment, if you wanted to create an app to do X, the chances are it would cost you at least $30,000, right? And we're saying, well, actually, this will lower the cost to practically zero for the Tor app. And if we have facilities for students who make apps in informatics to just file it away, we haven't done this yet, but you need some kind of way of metadata, describing what's in there in our data store. And then somebody comes along and they find for a rather little small amount of money they can modify something and create something new. So that's the basis of the business case at the moment, which is sort of new things you can do you couldn't do before without a lot of money, and cost save for things that you would have done. But on top of that, then there's, will the council pay for access to this, for example?
How do you sustain interest and build communities? If you take OpenStreetMap, for example,
yes.
after initial burst of interest, I think maybe eight people maintain it, run it. It's a very small number.
Is that right? Yeah.
So you're trying to have huge outreach, different parts of communities, kids, university. At the initial interest, how do you retain that?
Well, I think my experience is, and it's not just mine, is that usually what happens is that, you know, 90% of the effort comes from about 1% of the people involved. But you don't know which 1% it is until you've exposed this thing to, you know, so on iSpot, you know, we have 60,000 people registered. But, you know, 90% of the identification is done by a few hundred people. And there are one or two people who probably never sleep because they seem to do, you know, so much.
How do you change that model?
How do you change that? I'm not sure. I think it's maybe some kind of law out there, you know, an unwritten law. I mean, it's log normal, you know, and I don't think you can change that. I think what you can do is just increase the total value of n, you know, make it if you can make it, if you could just. You might increase the number of people who registered with your site by 10,000, and that might add 100 people to the small group who are really doing lots of stuff. And then out of that, some really cool things might happen that then attract a lot more people. So I mean, sorry, this is a sort of rather hand-waving reply to your question. I suppose what I'm saying is I don't know, but...
technology counts as being a push or pull.
Yes.
Push things through the system or pull things through the system. Obviously, yes. You have a few hundred folk. Probably like Wikipedia folk as well.
Yes.
They're really into it.
Yes.
I'm going to do 2 hours of Wikipedia, anything to do, whatever.
Yes.
You go on and you go, right, what can I do now that I'm here?
Yes.
Or I'm interested, I'm an expert in whatever, list that on the site, and then anything that can bring in that remit.
That's
really
right.
Interested in asking that, but the technology exists and that will then push any inquiry in your direction, and then so you will then contribute.
That's right.
So but that's all technology, middleware, sort of.
So it's community and tools
that helps build everything up. But
yeah. Could
it have been possible to do that several years ago or whatever? And who knows what would be possible 3 or 4 years now from now as well? And stuff like that.
That's right. So it's you know, community, it's tools, and it's, you know, giving people what they really want and need. And I hope you'll give me some examples of this. This kind of thing is going to be useful in your teaching, those of you who teach, and those of you who do other things, maybe find other uses for it. A lot of this will be built by students. There are 300 MSc students a year in informatics looking for projects, apparently.
Well, so, every student here.
So, you know, I mean, I think... this could be a place where the students doing geography, the students doing informatics, the students doing other things can all meet in a synergistic way, and across years as well. Because you know the idea is that nothing will be lost; everything will be saved. So the students of this cohort, year's cohort, could produce things that will be of use in 2 or 3 years' time when they've left. Mostly that sort of thing doesn't happen. Certainly biology, I might ask, you know, what happened to the vegetation data you collected on Braid Hill, you know, 10 years ago, Richard? And he says, I don't know.
what comes to mind is what we grappled with for many years in the world of GIS is metadata analysis. So,
right.
You know, which is the key to then discovering, retrieving anything, and if that's too difficult to do, then actually it's quicker to reinvent the wheel rather than spend hours drifting, you know, flooding through the catalogs to then find stuff that you can only once you start using do you then come across the fact that it's not actually fit for a purpose, but you've
Well, I mean, I realise that that's important. I have to admit, we haven't addressed that yet. So I'd be really interested to know, I mean, what's the state of the art in metadata catalogues?
Well, it's nothing to do with a technical thing. It's about how bothered people can actually do. Because do folk use it?
Yes.
Is the key thing.
Okay.
Do folk use it, then do folk use it properly?
Yes.
And then Do folk use it to then retrieve the data?
Right.
And does that provide them enough information
yes.
to actually make that qualitative decision whether to okay. reinvent the wheel themselves or retrieve that stuff? Worth investigating it anyway, and it's very difficult to.
Okay, but that would suggest to me that the work needs to be done not perhaps in the design of a metadata library, but in the usability of the interface or something. I mean.
But also, if you've got a network of sensors, then they can populate lots of stuff about how that data is collected
yes, yes.
in that instance that nobody yes. has to, you know, the person doing
it. I think that, you know, at some point, as, you know, the data, the issue of data quality, which needs to be in there with the metadata as well, you know, who collected these data, what's, you know, what do we know about the quality of their identification skills, if that should be relevant, whatever it might be. So, yeah, there's a lot of research in here too required.
Thanks, it's fascinating.
Oh, hi, yeah.
Really glad to drag this forward. Obviously, I work on tropical forests, and I can see why this is focused in Edinburgh.
Yes.
Part of this, but can we apply some of the things you've developed here to other places?
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, it's borderless. I mean, you can see from the way I introduced it why Edinburgh, but I don't see this as. I mean, obviously, you know, I'm here, we are here, we've got all these things. Let's make it great, and then other people will copy it, use it. I don't see us providing them with you know sort of a service as such. Although actually, maybe we would. I mean, maybe they'll just say that's a cool idea. We'll do one, and that would be, that. You know, I think that would be good. I mean, I think copying is a serious form of flattery. As long as we're able to keep ahead. Yeah. But I mean, you also think it could be useful elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that obviously other people are doing. You see, generally, like,
yeah.
the same place with open source code.
Yes.
Well, I can see immediately how it applies to try and map mining concessions and forestry concessions in Cameroon, the way we've got.
Right.
Just because they keep overlapping the two by the stakes, and they have good GIS data, so I can see how we use this.
Okay, fantastic. Well, maybe we should have a chat. Yep.
Very thought-provoking talk, John. Thank you. I'm just wondering, I'm sort of thinking through, you've given us a lot of information in terms of what this might be, what it might contain, and the extent to which it risks becoming a sort of huge monolithic system into which all the data resides, versus building something that links to existing data infrastructures and builds the data where it needs it. There's a risk that we've faced for many years in GIS, and I think we've got beyond that, of saying, no, what we don't want to do is pull in everybody else's data into our system, but actually use it in place. And I'm just wondering where you've got to in terms of that.
Yes, I mean, it's still very early days, but we're conscious of that fact. So I think at the moment what happens is that the sort of code in Jupyter Hub that uses those open data sources actually looks at the originals data on the Scottish Open Data Hub to update itself. So we don't try and store every version or the latest version, but I think the code actually looks for the latest version. We have created our own data store just because it. Otherwise, the speed at which you can do things is limited by the speed at which the open data service can serve your data. It's not set up to some. And also, we're using a kind of cookie cutter to take the Edinburgh data out of Scotland's data. So, but down the line, I mean, obviously, we want. There is also some code for pulling in data from OpenStreetMap, for example. So we will be. You know, I think that's one of the things. I mean, I'd like to talk to other people and you and others who have this kind of experience about what we should be doing because you've been there already.
So, can I just ask perhaps a provocative question as a geologist?
Yeah.
What's this system going to tell me about the geology of Edinburgh and how can I find out about more that hadn't contributed to the subject?
Well, I think it will depend on what you put in.
And as recipient.
Okay, if you're the recipient, then we will need some geologists to provide the information. I mean, so, you know, like I said, what we've got here is an infrastructure, or, you know, in, I tend to think of the seedbed. So in order for geology students to be able to find this useful, somebody has got to put the geology information in there. What might then happen is that somebody else says, ah, what happens if we map a place name that's mentioned in Hutton's theory of the Earth onto different formations in a geological map? And, you know, there are all things, once the data are in there, then people can do things that we perhaps don't anticipate. If you want a very specific thing, like, I mean, my map, my tour of the Botanics, for example, is based on a paper leaflet created by, you know, another lecturer previously. And what's new is that we can put in photographs, we can put in video. So you may already have, if you're teaching geology, you probably almost certainly will have a tour of the crags or something. You could put that into our tour app, but you could put photographs and videos on it as well, and share that with your students. And you could even set more advanced students the task of creating it, actually. So that's sort of the point, rather than answering your question directly, it's a way of helping you to answer it yourself.
The character reference thing you talked about, you know, the scanning, digitizing of the old stuff, and then geo-scanning it.
Yes.
I know Adina do that. So you could scan Hutton's original, like all geologists have field notebooks.
Yes.
Scan field notebooks, geocode the entries as well. So they're in fantastic. Only takes, you know, not small leisure, I'm not belittling it, but, you know, only takes a couple of people to do that task, plow through.
Well, some of it may already have been
And get them up there, and then
I mean, you can get the theory of the Earth on Gutenberg, I think, you know, already. It's digitized. It won't necessarily have the level of detail
the key thing is getting it into your digital characters, character recognition thing that will take a geologist to go through.
I mean, you know, you could say there's nothing new here. It's a bunch of maps, and you know. But the point is the context and bring it all together. So.
Okay, we're heading towards
Bristol. Yes, but as we're asking about this, of course, I'm not. I mean, this is how you can buy 3 years after your inaugural lecture. what you say about this after 3 years?
I was so naive! Okay, what I would hope to be able to do is actually to have a number of people here who could tell you about what they've done with Cityscope, including some students and maybe some staff. And I would just sit there and feel smug.
Right, okay. Well, on that note, I think we will just about let you off the hook. I'll save what happens in asking a technical question about the Jupiter thing, but I'll save that for.
Okay.
So, thank you all for coming. We have further talk. I think there are other research groups with talks related. I will send out information in due course. But another final sort of talk for this series, mid May, 19th of May. So, we'll look out for that. It's up on the website. But thank you all for coming, and thank you indeed to John for a very interesting talk.